Okay, all my wide awake third period students. Just an aside, some of you might have wondered, Brother Jay, why didn't you bring the greetings from the Roselle Village Ecclesia? Well, we're all here. Today, we're going to take a look at Elihu. And another aside here. illustrations for this class have all been done by my talented son. And obviously, we have no idea what Job, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu look like. But I thought it would be helpful if it just had a face to go along with these arguments, just so you could sort of kind of keep them straight as we were going through them. So here's what we know about Elihu. His name means, "He is my God." He is the son of Barakel, which means God blesses, a Buzzite. And that means contempt. There are some conclusions we might draw from these. I always hate to do that with names. It seems like there's something there. I usually let it be with me, all right, and let other people draw their own conclusions. But so I'm going to do that today, too. I'm not going to do that. So what do we know? We know Buzz was a son of Nahor. Nahor was a brother of Abraham. And you might remember they talk about Huzz and Buzz. And we talked about Huzz earlier being another name for Uz. Gad also had a descendant by the name of Buzz. It is a place mentioned, again, in Jeremiah 25, along with Dedan and Tema. But again, it's among those nations who are going to drink of the cup of God's wrath. And so we don't necessarily know where it is geographically. He's supposed to have been from the family of Ram, meaning higher exalted. We know that Judah had a son, grandson, great-grandson, called Ram, and that Ram himself was a great-great-grandfather of Boaz. But, of course, being the brother of Abraham, or being from the tribe of Gad, or being from the tribe of Judah, in the end, we don't really have a biblical connection between Ram and Buzz. So, in all of these individuals, I think the information is given to us, like a lot of things in the Bible, because these are real people. This is their heritage. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we can trace it back anywhere. And beyond that, there might be some other things of value, but I'll leave that to you as well. Because some Bible students are better on names and going into that sort of thing. All right, so we start with Elihu. He just appears, not really out of nowhere. He's obviously been there all along, listening to all of these arguments. But now he wants to put forth his two cents. And so he begins by saying, and trying to make the case of why he should be heard. He says, "Age should speak, years should teach wisdom. But Shaddai, the Almighty, also inspires men. And so we get from this information that Elihu is most likely younger than Job and his friends. He says, great men are not always wise, nor is judgment with the aged. Therefore, hearken to me, I will show you my opinion. Right off, he has No. I hope I don't have this going on all through this here. Let's get it all on the screen. He says, Job has justified himself. That's his charge. And that Job's friends have condemned Job, but they had no answer. That is, they weren't really able to refute his arguments. So, he's not happy. And then we have the things that I just mentioned here. I'm sorry this thing came up out of order. I thought I had checked this before, but best laid plans, as they say. So he says, I listened to your arguments. Now let me say this. We've got several chapters of this, 32 through 37, all belong to Elihu. And 32, we have a lot of Elihu, in fact, all of chapter 32 has to do with why he should be heard. It has nothing to do with advancing the argument. He's just there to tell you, hey, it's about time you listen to me because you're not resolving things. None of you convinced Job or refuted his arguments. Again, let's just get these all up there. Job didn't address me in the foregoing arguments, and I will not use your arguments. So he says, I am full of words. I will show no favor. In fact, my maker would put an end to me if I did. So, what we see him doing here at this point is he's making assertions regarding Job and his friends. Elihu appears to be correct with regard to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. But what we want to check is he correct regarding Job? So again, let's get these all up here. So he says, Job, listen to all my words. I will speak my mind sincerely. The Almighty has given me the breath of life. Refute me if you can. I'm fashioned from the clay, same as you. Fear not, I will place no heavy pressure on you. And he's obviously referring to the way Job has talked about the Lord's hand being heavy on him. But Elihu says, oh, you don't have to fear that. I'm just like you. So he's trying to convince Job that he has something to say that is worth listening to. So he says, You, Job, said, I am clean, without transgression. I am innocent, not guilty. Yet God accuses me. He regards me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and watches me. So, let's do a fact check. Is this what Job said? That I am without, or that I am clean? In Job 16:17, we see he says, not for any injustice in my hands, also my prayer is pure. That's as close as he gets to clean. He never really says, I am clean, without transgression. In Job 7:21, and why dost thou not pardon my transgression and take away mine iniquity? For now shall I sleep in the dust, and thou shalt seek me in the morning, but I shall not be. Well, here he asks pardon of a transgression, but as we discussed before, he doesn't know what it is. He just wonders why it can't be pardoned. In Job 10:7, he says, thou knowest that I am not wicked, and there is none that can deliver me out of thine hand. Is this right? All right. Boy, it seems like having some difficulty here. Okay, without transgression. Okay, so this is the next part. That I am without transgression. So in 13:23, Job said, how many are mine iniquities and my sins? Make me to know my transgressions and my sin. And in the next chapter, my transgression is sealed up in a bag, and thou sewest up my iniquity. In Job 31:33, if I covered my transgressions as Adam by hiding mine iniquity in my bosom. Okay. Again, Job is looking for someone to reveal the actual transgression for which he is being punished. Make me to know my transgressions. Sealing his transgression in the second one here is putting the seal as a king's seal on a sin. So the sin is in a sealed bag that can be used against him, but he can't open it to see what it is. And so you sewest up my iniquity, which is, of course, the same kind of thought. The allusion to Adam is sinning but keeping quiet or hiding due to shame or contempt to be suffered if it became widely known. But he's saying, you know, I didn't do that. And then he says that Job said, neither iniquity. Job 10:6. That thou inquirest after mine iniquity and searchest after my sin. And in 10:14, if I sin, then thou markest me and thou wilt not acquit me of mine iniquity. In 31:11, for this is an heinous crime, yea, it is an iniquity to be punished by the judges. And in 31:28, this also were an iniquity to be punished by the judge, for I should have denied that God is above. And that's part of his speech at the end where he says, if I've committed iniquity, then I should be punished. So it's clear from these passages that Elihu's assertion regarding Job has only a hint of truth in it. Job feels he's lived righteously, which is true, and was confirmed by God at the beginning of the book. He may have transgressed and committed iniquity, but he's unaware of what it might be. So he ends by listing some iniquitous deeds that he agrees are punishable, but he doesn't agree that he's committed them. Back to Elihu's case against Job. He said, you, Job, said, he, that is God, findeth occasions against me, and he, God, counteth me for his enemy. So, once again, let's do a fact check. You find occasion against me. Oh, he never said that. There's no place we can find where that wording is used. And you count me for your enemy. In Job 6:26, it says, do ye imagine, which is another, it's the same word that would be count. Do you imagine to reprove words and the speeches of one that is desperate, which are as wind? However, that particular passage is from Job's answer to Eliphaz, not to God, and is unrelated to the charge. That God takes him as his enemy. So, we see in Job 13:24, wherefore hidest thou thy face and holdest me for thine enemy? Hidest is the same word as translated counteth in Elihu's charge, and holdest me for thine enemy. In Job 19:11, he hath also kindled his wrath against me, and he counteth me unto him as one of his enemies. In Job 27:7, let mine enemy be as the wicked, and he that riseth up against me as the unrighteous. Job 13:24, well, we just mentioned that, but the last one, 27:7, doesn't seem to refer to God, but to some general unknown enemy, or perhaps even Job's friends. But the overall assertion of Elihu for this appears to be true. Again, Elihu comes up with, you said, God putteth my feet in the stocks. God marketh all my paths. Feet in the stocks, marking the paths. Let's check that out. Job 13:27, thou puttest my feet also in the stocks and lookest narrowly unto all my paths. Thou settest a print upon the heels of my feet. Job 7:20, I have sinned. What shall I do unto thee? O thou preserver of men, why hast thou set me as a mark against thee, so that I am a burden to myself? And finally in Job 14:16, for now thou numberest my steps. Dost thou not watch over my sin? So Job did say this. In Job 7:20, actually, this was one of those places where we have the Tikkun Zofarim, that I am a burden to myself, where it's actually been changed from what it was, burden to you, God. We consider also that in chapter 13, which is our first reference here, Job thinks God has possibly resorted to scrutinizing Job's youth to find sins for which he might punish him. We talked about that before. So at this point, he's come up with his case against him, and now he makes a charge that his speech about God is unjust, that he is guilty of pride. In this charge about being unjust, he says, God is greater than man. God does not give any account of his matters. God opens the ears of a man in a dream and seals his instruction. Now, we might ask the question, that being the case, if it is, does Elihu think this will happen to Job? Or does he think it has already happened to Job and Job has ignored it? And thus the fallout. Or does Elihu think that God has made him the messenger to bring Job instruction? Regarding the pride, he says, instruction also hides pride from a man and keeps him from the pit and from perishing by the sword. He's chastened with pain upon his bed and strong pain to his bones. He can't eat. His flesh is consumed. His bones appear beneath his skin. He comes close to death. And after reading that, I said to myself, so Elihu knows that these symptoms, which Job has, are to be associated with pride. I don't know how he came up with that, but it's very interesting. So Elihu has a remedy. Now, didn't he say, I'm not going to use the same arguments? But it looks to me like they're the same arguments. He says, you need to repent. You need an angel, one among a thousand, he says, to vouch for your uprightness. And I always like how he puts himself forward as the guy who's working for him, for Job, but everything he says seems to be working against him. And then God is gracious. And God would say, redeem him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. So again, we wonder if Elihu thinks he is this messenger, the one in a thousand. He says that when God is gracious, all these problems are reversed. Your flesh is fresher than a child. God accepts this man's prayers. And God repays the man for his righteousness. Again, repays the man for his righteousness. So, blessings are owed for righteousness, according to his thinking here. He goes on to say, that the person who repents says, I sinned. Remember, God said Job was blameless and upright, who feared God and shunned evil. If Job has sinned, it happened after the disasters came upon him. And if he sinned after the disasters came upon him, Satan was right and God was wrong. God might also be charged with bad judgment, since after Job's loss, he didn't sin. And after the boils, Job did not sin. Then why didn't God declare victory and end the test? This is also related to why some people think Satan and Job's friends are equivalent, that somehow Job's friends are able to elicit a sin in the frustration Job had with his friends' reasoning. However, if so, it was not because of anything Satan requested God to do to Job, which Satan thought would cause Job to sin. So, Elihu says, this man who repents will say, I sinned. And then he will say, I perverted what was right, and it gained me nothing. God redeemed me from going down into the pit. Now my life sees light. And then he adds, God will do this two or three times to bring a man back from the pit. Really? How does he know this? So yes, he seems to be using arguments that Job's three friends used, the arguments that he said he was not going to use. So he continues now. He's still making a case against Job. And let's get all this up here again. Okay. He says, Job, pay attention. Listen to me. Keep quiet, and I will speak. If you have anything to say, answer me. Speak. I want to show you are right. If not, listen to me. Keep quiet, and I will teach you wisdom. So, keep quiet, speak, and keep quiet. He says, hear my words, you sages. Listen to me, you who know so much. The ear tests words as the palate tests food. Let us choose for ourselves what is just. Let us decide for ourselves what is good. Again, the wording just doesn't ring right, you know. Choose for ourselves what is just. Choose for ourselves what is good? I don't know. Elihu is either a very wise man or he's a blowhard. A person who blusters and boasts in an unpleasant way. He continues. You said, I am righteous. God has taken away my judgment. So let's do another fact check here. I am righteous. Job 27:6. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live. Then he has taken away my judgment. Job 19:7, behold, I cry out of wrong, but I am not heard. I cry out, but there is no judgment. 27:2, as God liveth, who hath taken away my judgment, and the Almighty, who hath vexed my soul. So, Job did say this. He goes on to say, you said, should I lie against my right? My wound is incurable without transgression. Well, let's check this out. I lie against my right. Job 27:5, God forbid that I should justify you, that would be his three friends in this particular case, till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me. To lie against my right is essentially to go along with you. That is, Job succumbing to the arguments of his friends would be to lie against his own righteousness. My wound is incurable. Job 6:4, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit. The terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. And in Job 30:15, terrors are turned upon me. They pursue my soul as the wind, and my welfare passeth away as a cloud. So again, Job did, at least in effect, say this. And then he says that he said, and it's without transgression. Well, he doesn't say that, without transgression. Job doesn't claim that he's without transgression. Only he says, if I have transgressed, I'm not aware of what it is. So Elihu now pumps up more charges. He says, Job drinks in scoffing like water. Job keeps company with evildoers and wicked men. Job says, there is no profit to delight oneself with God. Well, these charges are completely false. There is no profit in God. The point Job makes in chapter 21 about the wicked succeeding in life, if you remember, we went through that a bit, the whole idea that Job attacked their premise that God punishes the wicked. And he said, well, sometimes that doesn't happen. And that's the closest that he got to saying that there's no profit in, because he said that's what the rich say. What do we want to know the Almighty for, right? So essentially, Elihu has come up with this charge to say that men reap what they sow, God is not unjust, and so what Job has done with respect to God is essentially, if he says that the things that you've said about God are unjust, then you're saying they are slanderous. And if they are slanderous, then it's blasphemy. That's the charge, essentially, against Job. And I think it's important because when we think of it in terms of this being set up as a basis for condemning him, that this was the same charge that was made in the trial of Jesus by the Sanhedrin. Jesus was just, he was without sin, yet his true claim to be the Son of God was dismissed as blasphemous. Just Job is dismissed as a liar, wicked, and one who accuses God of iniquity, even though we know that Job is looking to this same God for justification. Job does not waver, yet he does not completely understand why God has treated him the way that he has. So Elihu now wants to expand his charges, and he's going to tell Job what he can expect as the outcome of all this wicked, evil outworkings of Job. He says, first, Job, you have to understand that the things God does, he doesn't do anything that's wicked. And we'd probably agree with that. Men receive payment for what they do. Each receives in accordance with his conduct. You reap what you sow. Shaddai does not pervert justice. Actually, Bildad said this earlier in Job 8:6. Then he says, did someone put God in charge of the earth? In other words, is there a higher power than God that God himself has to bend to? And then he goes on to say that God is, I mean, the whole point of bringing that up is the idea that God is greater than we can even think. No, nobody put God in charge of the earth. God is in charge, period. And if God gathered all his spirit and breath, all flesh would perish. And that's true. So then he says, now just intimating that he's speaking about Job, should a hater of justice be in control? Would you call a king a scoundrel or a wicked, nobles wicked? Then don't condemn the just and mighty one. He is not a respecter of persons. He keeps watch on all. Wrongdoers cannot hide from him. This business about, okay. I knew I had a note on this, and it wasn't here. That's because I'm not to it yet. So let's look at his reasoning here in the syllogism. Its premise is, God does what is just. That's a good premise. Observation, Job questions what God has done to him. His conclusion is, Job hates justice. I don't see that that necessarily follows, but that's what he comes up with. So going on with Job's expected outcome, God doesn't warn people when they must be judged, he says. The mighty are shattered, not needing to investigate. They are overturned. They know not what they're doing. They are treated like criminals for all to see. Cries of the poor and oppressed come before him. Everything gets opened up and everything is spilled out, and all this evil is shown to the world. Now this part, of course, is really good, because now he comes back and he says, has anyone said to God, I've been chastised without having offended. Teach me what I have failed to see. If I've done wrong, I will do it no more. And he rounds this out, saying to Job, must God's rewards meet your approval? Obviously, Elihu is mocking Job at this point. All right, I know we've got 10 minutes left, but stand up, stretch. All right, 10 minutes and 8 slides. So Elihu comes up with a charge again. Job speaks without knowledge or wisdom. Well, we know Job would agree that he lacks knowledge, but what Elihu is saying is that his arguments are without knowledge or wisdom. He also says that Job answers like wicked men. And to his sin, Job has added rebellion. And I would say that all three of those charges appear to be nonsense. But Elihu's not through. He says, you said my righteousness is more than God's. And you said, what profit or advantage to be cleansed from my sin? Well, let's check it. My righteousness is more than God's. He did not say that. And this business about what advantage is it to have your sin covered, he says, the closest thing we have here is in Job 21:15. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit should we have if we pray unto him? But that's his response to Zophar, talking about what the rich say, not what he believes himself. So there's nothing there either. So then, from that, he goes on to come up with more of the things that Job can expect as a result. If you sin, he says, how do you hurt God? If your crimes are many, how do you affect God? Well, of course, you don't. But I think what he's trying to say here at this point is, with the sin and the crimes, is that the context is the rebellion part he just charged him with. So if you're rebelling against him, how do you think you're going to actually hurt him? If you are righteous, what do you give him? Well, if you are righteous, what do you give him? You give him obedience, right? And this is to God's glory, and it's the only thing that anybody can give him, is obedience to his word. It's true, we can't give him anything material because everything that's material is his. What does God receive from you? Your evil or righteousness can only affect humans. So again, more charges. He says oppressions cause people to cry out. Pride causes no one to ask, where is my maker? Is God my maker? People cry, but no one answers because of evil pride. Your evil or righteousness can only affect humans. The Almighty pays no attention to empty cries. Job oppresses people. Job exhibits evil pride. Elihu states this as a general principle, but clearly Job is the target here. Elihu sees Job's cries to God for help in this matter as empty cries. These charges are not only false, they're outrageous. Again, his expected outcome. You say you shall not see him, but judgment is before him. Trust him. Because you don't trust him, he has visited in anger. So he's saying essentially, the problems and the misery that you are undergoing is because you don't trust him, and God has visited you in anger. You don't know it because of your arrogance. So Job is not, in his view, Job is not aware of this, that he is the problem, because he's arrogant. He's full of pride. So Elihu now comes up as he closes out with some final assertions. He says that he speaks on God's behalf. This, of course, is interesting because following Elihu, God speaks. So, God upholds the righteous. That would be true. God warns the wicked to repent. I'm not sure that that is always true. I think people who have made a covenant with God, people who are trying to promote a relationship with God, are the people that he tends and cares for. And so if they go astray, I think they do get the warnings. But some people, I don't know that they're ever warned because God is not in their minds at all. They are sort of divorced from the situation. Prosperity to the obedient, death to the disobedient. Yes, but that may not happen until the resurrection. Job chose the way of the disobedient. And so there is a warning to Job. So Elihu says, with regard to this, my knowledge comes from afar. I ascribe righteousness to my Maker. My words will not be false. He that is perfect in knowledge is with thee, Job. Well, who is that? Is that Elihu? Or is he saying that God is speaking through him? Is that what it is? Because there is wrath, he goes on to say, because there is wrath, beware lest he take thee away with a stroke, and then no ransom can deliver thee. Elihu reasons just like Job's friends, but he seems to be, in my view anyway, much more arrogant. So his final assertions are these. This starts at the 22nd verse of chapter 36 and goes through the end of chapter 37. And it essentially is this. It is this. This which is not showing up. It doesn't matter. The final one is essentially, consider God with whom you contend, because you're taking on somebody that you can't win against. And so he goes through all this business of all these things that God is able to do and reasons why Job should take this warning and essentially follow the path that he's mentioned before, repent. Because that's his only way out of this. And as we shall see tomorrow, that's not the case. Something else happens instead. And so tomorrow we'll have the final chapter in this, which is Job's encounter with God. Now before we go to lunch, let's have a closing prayer. And I'll ask Brother Andrew to offer the prayer. Brother Andrew Johnson.